I only hear many people share the successes that they have, and that could be due to marketing, but I do both, and people tend to get more value from the actual mistakes. So you can learn from those. That way you don't make those as well.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everyone? Got another great interview in store for you today. But before I get to that, you know the fee. If you found any value from this, please share with someone who also could get value from this in your life. Share it on your social platforms. Send it to a friend, family member, anyone who could get value. That's the only fee here. I don't make any money off this show. That's the fee. And if you haven't left a rating or review, I would be very appreciative if you did. That's how we get in front of more eyes and ears on that good Apple algorithm. All right, everybody, enough of that. Let's get to it. The guest I have on the show today, his name is Sterling White. Sterling has a great story that we get into, from living in a not so great part of Indianapolis and struggling to really find his way at the beginning. And then it was just a simple mindset shift that he had, a way of thinking about success and money differently that really, you know, projects him from having, as he said, a negative net worth to owning over 500 multifamily units. We go in specifically how he's been able to take those down. He said all have been off market. So he talks about the strategies he uses to find off market deals. And you might think, oh, he's probably doing 10 to 50, 60 units. No, he actually recently took down his latest, I think, was 156 units. So it works for the big boys too. So we talk a lot about strategy of finding deals off market, talk a lot about a mindset stuff too, how he structures his day to be able to get everything done, because he also produces a lot of content on the different social platforms. That's how he's able to get his name out there, raise money, and take down all these deals. So we get into a lot of good stuff. It's one you're definitely going to want to take some notes on. There's a lot of actionable items. And he's just a really great dude. I had a great time talking with Sterling. So without further ado, here is Sterling White. Hey, Sterling, welcome to the show, man. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to get on here.
Yeah, super excited. Everyone, go ahead and get your popcorn ready, whether it's gluten-free or just regular popcorn. And we're going to take you along for a show. So definitely stay tuned.
I love it. All right, we're going to have some fun. Let's do it. So who is Sterling White? What does he do? And how did he get where he is today?
Yeah, so answering that question, I'm actually still figuring that out myself.
I think we all are, man.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a whole rabbit hole in itself, but I'll give everyone just a spark note version. Is born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, not so good parts of the city where people that live in those environments quickly try and get out. But a lot of times is you're just stuck there, unfortunately. And single mother, fraternal twin brother. Some people say he's as dark as Wesley Snipes. I don't think he's that dark. And I remember once, Sean, that him and I were 5 years old. And we're sitting at a kitchen table. And as soon as we get done eating, we go upstairs and then a bullet comes right through the back patio where we were sitting.
Wow.
So that is from that experience, as you never knew as if you would actually live until the next day. And fast forward, how I got into entrepreneurship is I had to figure out a way to earn money in a legal sense for myself, because there was tons of illegal activity that was going on around me. And in middle school, my first product was Kool-Aid, then Pokemon cards. And fast forward, how I got into real estate was my friend's dad owned a construction company and I started as a laborer. And then shortly after that, I read the book. Everyone's so familiar with this, which is Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I saw that people are the wealthy and rich didn't get that way by being laborers. So I started investing and bought my very first property, no money out of pocket, because I actually partnered with someone who brought the cash. I got thrown into the fire to figure everything else out and then scaled to 150 single families and then started buying multifamily in about 3.5-4 years, got to about 500 units.
Wow. And I'm sure there's a lot more in between how you got to that, but that's impressive. So Sterling, how did you make that transition from you were a laborer working for a construction company to then realize that this is not what I want to do? I actually want to invest in this thing I'm building. How did you make that transition?
First and foremost, I made the decision. Okay, I no longer want to be a laborer on the construction side. I want to start investing. Now the decision is made. Okay, I'm at A. I want to get to Z. Now, how do I bridge the gap? And at that point is I wanted to start buying single families, but I was 23 years old at that time and didn't have any cash. I actually owed the bank money, not being financially smart. And then also credit score, which is not as important, but that would even register when you would pull it. So I started doing all the researching is how do I start to find these deals? Is I was attending networking events. I was putting up the bandit signs. I was doing handwritten letters. And it just so happened to be the person that I was working for, which was my mentor, for completely free. Yes, I said completely free, that they had multifamily and they wanted to buy single families. Normally, it's the other way around.
Right.
He didn't have the time to find the deals, but he did have the cash. I had the time, but I didn't have the cash. And then that's where we were able to get that first partnership together.
That's awesome. And listeners, if you haven't got into your own deal yet and want to, in my opinion, that's the best way to do it. Find someone who's already doing it, bring something to the table that maybe they don't have or don't want to do, because we all have things we don't want to do. Trust me, bring that to the table. And that's a great way to get into it. Okay. So Sterling, once you were there, is that how you continued to stack the portfolio, as you were kind of the deal hunter? And what was your strategy? That's obviously a big part of the game, right? Finding the deal, especially hot market. That's probably the hardest thing to do. How are you doing that?
At that time, the market was not as hot as it is in today. At the time of shooting this was 2013, beginning of 2014. So there was that. And so there was multiple ways that was buying property, because in order to buy 150 single families, there's a lot of volume and a lot of transactions. Yeah. It would have been good if this was a package of 150 single families. That was not the case. It was a lot of one-offs. If lucky, would get a package of 2-3 here and there, but that was very rare. So it was taking multiple avenues, the bandit signs, and then also the handwritten letters. And then at that time, was able to get some deals, very minimal, from wholesalers, and then also submitting a lot of offers on the listed properties. But however, when the shift was made to multifamily, it was an entirely different strategy, because it was an entirely different cycle in the market as well.
Yeah. So let's make that transition here. So how did you find multifamily deals? Did you carry any of that skill set into it?
The skill set of, hey, you're at A, you want to get to Z, figure out a way to bridge the gap. So there was that skill set. Yeah. And however, the strategy that was used, and I'll just go into the very first deal, is one was going through brokers. That wasn't working, because this was in 2017, where I would submit for a deal. When I say I, there is a team involved, is that there would be an aggressive, I would say top of our more aggressive type offer, and people were offering 10, 15, 20% more than that.
Wow.
So I took a step back and said, okay, well, why not beat the brokers to the punch and go direct to the owner? And how that very first property was found, which was a 46 unit in Indianapolis, was took the driving for dollars approach, picked a specific neighborhood, drove past this one property in particular, parking lot looked like an alligator's back. It was just very bland. And from there, just simply because all this is public information, everyone, so it's at your fingertips. And then just simply picked up the phone. Yay or nay, would you be interested in selling your property? That wasn't the actual word for word how I said it, but similar to that.
That's awesome. So I can think of a question that someone might have that's new to this. Sterling, why would a seller just want to sell directly to you and not go to like a broker where they could get highest and best?
So in this particular scenario, he did go through a broker, which happened to be his sister, and it was listed for $1.3 million and didn't get much traction from that. And then that's when I just happened to call him at the right time. It also comes down to timing too. And this was his very last property that he was selling, because he was shifting from being a apartment operator to being a debt collector. And really, it comes down to building a relationship. And I know that sounds cliche, but it really does come down to that, because the owners that I've actually been able to transition from owner to a seller, that's exactly what it came down to. And they had brokers that were reaching out to them, but it was just something about those brokers and then also listing it on the market. They didn't want to deal with any of that. They just wanted to deal directly with someone and not have a middleman.
Yeah. I also think it's really important to, in that situation, to be flexible and tactical and don't stop at no, yes, yeah, prices are crazy. Even like recently, we've seen that, right? And you've got to go, above and beyond just like, I need, it's like you said, it's all about relationships, but it doesn't just have to be brokers. It can be direct with the sellers. And I don't know if you would agree with this, but usually it is a longer game, right? Building those relationships with the seller, but it's way more fruitful.
Yeah.
Any other type of strategies you've used to build those relationships?
Well, just going back to that point is there's a lot of work that goes into it, but you do have savings because one deal in particular, this was one thing that the caveat, these are properties in Indianapolis. So when I mentioned some of these numbers, people are thinking you bought that for, let's say the 46 unit for $900,000 is that purchase price. People are thinking that in California, I can't even get a single family house for that. So that's one thing too. And these are, I would say, solid C neighborhoods and some of them on the cusp of B minus to B. But
that was also 2017 too, right? So I'm sure they're worth way more now.
Exactly. And there's actually a property now under contract. This is a 156 unit that acquired 2 years ago. On our 5-year projections, we projected that we would be able to sell it for $9.8 million. And someone, we're under contract on it now for $10.8 million. So that just goes to show you, one, we were able to get a good deal on the buy-in, but also is the market just went up. So that also helped with the appreciation on that.
Yeah, it's always about buying, right? But sometimes we can ride that wave of the market, which we have in the last 2 years.
And also just going back to what you were mentioning, some additional tips is that a mistake I do see people make is they're following up with the same messaging is now you're just in selling your property. Now you're just in selling your property. Now you're just selling your property. I know people who are listening to this is Sterling's very annoying by saying that 3 times, but that's exactly how people follow up. And that's how it is from the owner's perspective or now that you're looking to transition to a seller. So if you're creatively following up, as an example, as being value-based, and you may ask, what is value-based? There is an owner, it's going on 3.5-4 years now, that someone drove one of their cars into one of his buildings. It wasn't on purpose, but yeah. So, and he needed a masonry to do the brickwork. When I started in construction, that friend of mine has a masonry company. So I sent it over to him. He actually used them. So that's just a prime example of just following up and being value-based. And there's also that rule of reciprocity, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When he does go to sell the property, he'll think of, oh, what first comes to mind? So you want to keep constantly staying top of mind.
Yeah, that a law of reciprocity, givers gain for sure, always pays back. And yeah, I think that's important. And I've seen success in that where it's obviously you got to ask if you want to sell up front, right? And then you drip it in there now and again, but it's also getting down to like, what's one important to them, to your point of bringing value. And then two, also just them as a person, because they're people too, they have lives. So I can think of one guy in particular, he older gentleman, but he still played pickup hockey. So sometimes when I'd reach out to him, I'd ask him like how the league's going and all that, and just let him talk. And then you build that familiarity and then they get comfortable with you. And then to your point, then you're top of mind when they go to sell. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think people do think it's just send another mail or send another email, make another phone call, and just be same thing again, just hit. And that's not how it can work like that, but it's not as often as what you're talking about. So,
and also there's different models on the single family side. When you're really at scale and you're targeting lists of 5,000, 10,000, I could see where someone isn't more relationship based because that's a different avatar of what is it, a seller. However, on the multifamily, when you're dealing with multi-million dollar properties, is it's worth investing more of your time because it's a bigger payoff.
100%. So have you taken all your deals down off market, or have you bought any through a broker?
On the multifamily side, all have been off market.
Wow. So you just mentioned 150 units, so it's even possible with the big boys.
Yeah. And that was one thing. And that's where it helps mindset. And then also putting on your blinders and not listening to people as well. Because I was told it wasn't possible to acquire something of that size going direct to the owner. But for everyone who was on here, I'm a testament of that actually being possible. The thing is that if you look at, I wouldn't even call it the law of averages, but is what does happen. And I'm also going to take the more realism approach too. The higher the unit count, the more sophisticated the operator. So they'll just, it's the likely chances is higher in that case for them to just go through an agent or just listen on the open market. So that's the other thing that you have to consider too, is that it's just more difficult the higher the unit count when it comes to that.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes you can tell that too, based on the LLC structure, how it's owned. If it's just like one LLC and then someone's name, there's a good chance that's probably just a mom and pop, right? But if it's an LLC and then another LLC and then another LLC, it's probably more sophisticated.
Exactly. Or if you're using a database to pull the information, normally they do a good job. Let's say Reonomy or CoStar, is they'll tell you how many properties that LLC is tied to or that number of properties that that owner is associated with. If they're at 13, 14, 15, 20, that's a good indication that the sophistication of that, because they're likely just in acquisitions mode. But if they own one or two, that's likely more of a mom and pop operator. Not saying that the likely to be a mom and pop operator, but that's not still the, always the case.
Yep. Have there been mom and pops that have had multiple where you bought multiple from them?
No, is from the all the deals that I've acquired, which was 46 unit, 50 unit, 280 units, and 156 unit, they've always owned less than three properties.
Okay. So Sterling's out there hustling many owners and taking these down. Love it. So what's the next step for you? Are you still buying in Indianapolis or have you gone to other markets?
Yeah. So no longer live in Indianapolis. February last year, I actually moved to Houston, Texas, where nice. They say everything is bigger except the toilet that I have here. But I think it's just a defective toilet. But I'll have to get it exchanged. That's here fine. In Houston, but haven't been acquiring anything as of late, just due where I see things going in the market and it just really hasn't made the most sense. So I've been selling and just positioning myself for once things, which I believe they will start to turn around. I actually need to look at the CPI results that came out today. And I know I just dated the podcast. Dang it. But I see things starting to turn around. So we'll position myself for that.
Let's see. I can see. Have they?
No, don't tell me just yet. I always wait till noon for any news, which this is.
I won't tell you that. I won't tell you.
In my investing career, I have not been as up to date on this as of this, because it really changed the trajectory of a lot of things. So also invested not just in real estate, but other assets out there.
So I come from the finance background and I've worked for a credit shop. So we had a lot of fixed income products. So it was tied to the treasury. So I've always tracked the 10-year, but I've never tracked it to the amount I've been tracking over the last few months, just because 30-year mortgages, loans for properties are tied to the 10-year, especially like an agency. So
quick thing, it's okay, but is it up or down, the inflation?
It cooled down a little bit.
Nice. Okay. Okay. All right.
But yeah, man, that's what's also fun about this game. I don't know about you, but it's just game to me, right? And that's what keeps me engaged. And I think it's very smart that you're taking some chips off the table, because I do think there's going to be opportunity. And we actually haven't bought anything yet this year. We were pretty strong last year. And it's not because we don't want to. It's just, like, to your point, we haven't found anything that makes sense for us and our investors. We're underwriting like crazy, but I'm not going to get into that whole FOMO game where I feel like I see he or her buying something, so I need to, so I can post it online. You know, like, that's not exactly what we're here for. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because I feel like a lot of people get trapped in that, which I know it's easy to do, but we're here to make money. We're not here to post stuff on social media. I know we have to do it because we're trying to build a business, but first and foremost, we're businessmen and women and investors.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why I very limited and restricted what I was just mentioning to you, is that I don't have any sensory. I don't check my text or any phone or any news. And I don't even do news. But just when it comes to this example, until 12, I get on social media once or twice a day and it's literally on and off. And I don't get any stories or anything, because exactly what you mentioned is, let's say you see someone else that closed on a deal. You don't know if they overpaid for the deal. You don't know how they underwritten all these different aspects, but you see just the highlight and then you have that instinct. And then now there's so many rabbit holes that I can go into that. But I would just say is that avoid the FOMO as much as you can.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And I heard, I think it was actually Brandon Turner who said it, to be a producer, not a consumer on social media. And I think that's really powerful, not just because obviously producing, you know, it's great for your business and growing your platform for that sense. But to your point, then you're not getting stuck in that rabbit hole, draining emotion from you, because where attention goes, energy flows, and that's not where you want it to be. So I didn't think I was going to ask you this question, but I'd love to jump into it, because you've already kind of alluded to it, because you're obviously very successful. You're a hustler. You get a lot done. And I'm sure that has a lot to do with how you structure your day. So if you wouldn't mind, would you share with us how you structure your days?
Yeah. So every day, one of the things that I do first and foremost is when I wake up, I think of all the things that I'm grateful for. And so that's first and foremost, I brush my teeth, all that kind of stuff. I wash up. And then also I take some time. I actually have a journal, which is just right over there. And I don't know if anyone's familiar with Marcus Aurelius, but he practiced Stoicism. And I'll just write my thoughts. Sometimes thoughts are sometimes just, what do you call that? Quotes, in a way, as an example, is seeing the world for what it is and not how I believe it should be, or people are going to act in their best interest, which many times their best interest is not in your best interest. So not taking anything personal. So I do all of those things. Is I'll wake up anywhere between 7 to 7:30 and no social media, no media, no checking texts, no emails until noon. And so there's that. And then how I have it structured is I'll start my workday between about, let's say, 8:30. And then at 8:30, that's when I'll say, OK, these are all the things that I need to get done. And I'll put everything into blocks. And then I also work out as well. So those are just some habits. I can go more into the nuts and bolts, but that's just a high level of how it's structured.
That's great. And I've heard that before from multiple people, how they don't touch their phone in the sense of like emails and social media before noon. They won't set up a meeting before noon so they can really do focused work of what they need to get done. And then noon and onward is when they can do those things. But I also like how you limit time on social media. And for listeners, if you're wondering like a good way to do that, if you have an iPhone, there is a function to set timers for any app on your phone for how much time you can use. And then it will just comes up and says time limit. You've reached your limit on, say, Instagram, for instance. And then you can go, there is a function where you can ignore it and then put in your code. And if you're someone who doesn't have self-discipline and will do that, what you should do is then get a friend, spouse, whoever, to put code without telling you. So then you can't do it. Trust me, it works.
And also on that is, if you haven't watched the documentary Social Dilemma, it's a great, great documentary that goes into that. But the unfortunate thing when it comes to these platforms and what you mentioned about discipline is it's tough because our brains are going against billions of dollars of technology, maybe in the trillions, as a way to keep us on these platforms. The YouTube algorithm, the stories is, I don't even watch people's stories, but I know that if you view a story, or let's say two stories or whatever the case is, I know it lines up at the top, is they'll figure out a way to keep pushing those people up there. And then, so it just keeps you hooked on there. So at all costs, if you can, very limit yourself, but you also have to take in consideration that you're in an uphill battle in essence.
100%. And just like watching what you put in your body when it comes to nutrition and food, you also have to watch what you put in your body when it comes to like data and that type of stuff, because you're right. It's an algorithm to keep showing you what you like. And so then also, this could go down a whole nother rabbit hole, but it creates groupthink where you only think in one sense and you think that is the only thing that's right.
Politics, for instance. But I'm not going to go down that, but that's just a prime example of they could just only show you and be biased. All right, we'll take another.
Maybe we can come back. Maybe you and I can start a different podcast. We'll talk about it.
Put on our, what do you call that? Our tin hats and everything.
Tinfoil time, everyone. All right, man. So let's talk about, if you don't mind, a deal itself, how you found it, why it was something you wanted to get after, how you took it down, and then if you still own it or not, talk about operations and all that good stuff.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the latest 156 units. So how that was acquired was pulled this particular property. It was a syndication that was put together about 20 years or so. So about two decades. And the most funny story about this is I remember visiting a friend of mine who actually lived at that property when I was 15, 16 years old. Never thought one day I would actually own it. So that's just one thing I want to share with people too. And so this was all a cold call by someone on my team who reached out to the owner. But how it came down is that I had to do a lot of researching to find out, because there was a lot of obituaries of people that just had died. And so I had to go through all these spider webs and then ended up finding the last name. It was a very unique last name of one of the people associated with the property. And I found them. They were actually out in Florida in real estate. So I said, well, let me go ahead and just give this person a call. Turns out there was two partners today that had the primary decision making, is that they said, yes, we would be open to an offer on the property, because in essence, they had ran out of cash and really couldn't make the improvement to get the property up to market. So it all started with the cold call. And then from there, the negotiations went back and forth and then finally settled on a price of just over $6.2 million. But easily, a broker said they minimally would have listed that for $7 million and it likely would have got bidded up from there.
That's awesome, man. And to your point of not being capitalized enough to bring property to market. I think that's what we're going to see in this market. And that's where a lot of opportunities are going to come from. One, people just weren't capitalized enough because they wanted to make a deal work. So they couldn't bring
it. I made that mistake, by the way, and we can get to that.
Well, let's say, yeah, we will. And so I think that's what's going to happen, especially with a lot of deals were bought with bridge debt. So that's going to be coming up in the next year or two. And with where rates are at, LTVs are low, most likely not going to be able to refinance. They're going to have to sell, and they're probably going to have to sell less than they figured, than they thought they could. So I think that's where opportunities are going to come from.
And when it comes to undercapitalizing the overpaying for properties, is that, as an example, the second deal that I ended up doing is it was a 50 unit and the deal was too tight on the number. So it was 1.4. And then we were actually going through a lender and then the lender backed out. Not a red flag, but we should have took that as a sign that we shouldn't have moved forward with the deal as well. Hindsight 2020. But in essence is that it was too tight on the numbers for us to raise all the money up front to then, as the units turn, to renovate those to then increase the rents. So what we thought is, hey, let's go ahead and take it out of cash flow. I heard this mistake time and again from other investors, and still, you know what? I'm going to be different, or we're going to be different. We'll figure this out. No, that wasn't the case. And years later, about 2 years later in 2019, had to end up selling that property, did okay as a return. But just think back to your point, Sean, is what if we were at a different point in the cycle? Then we would have had to try and ride it out, which it was already just break even and likely just in the negative. And where we were able to really get our bang for our buck was just that we bought at a decent basis and someone was just willing to pay more in that situation because we were at in the cycle.
Yeah. And it's about learning lessons, right? So even though you heard it, you still like, I can make this work, but now you know, because you actually experience it and you won't do that again. And I think that's important. But yeah, that's definitely cash flow, not for CapEx. And
exactly,
there's plenty of people that do make that mistake. And it's really important to not undercapitalize for sure.
And someone listening to this is going to make the mistake too.
Oh, 100%.
But yes.
And I've made the mistake, to your point, of when there's like a red flag or something that comes up that is probably you should let you know that you shouldn't do the deal, but you do it anyways because you want to take it down. I've done that too. So I know how that feels. And it's just a stepping stone. It's something we learn. And anyone that wants to partner with someone, it's good to hear these stories, right? So say you wanted to partner with Sterling, you wanted to be passive on one of his deals. A great question is asked is like, do you have any battle scars? And if you do, tell me about them. And if someone says no, I personally wouldn't trust them. Everyone has battle scars. So, and if they're willing to be open and share, I appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, transparency is key. And I know it's not all sunshine and rainbows. And that's one of the good feedbacks I've gotten from people is they say that it's good that you actually share the mistakes, because I only hear many people share the successes that they have. And that could be due to marketing. But I do both. And people tend to get more value from the actual mistakes. So you can learn from those. That way, you don't make those as well.
Yeah. And I think to that point, that's why everyone should have a mentor. It's not necessarily about show me the way. It's show me the way not to go, the things that I've done wrong. And I think that's an important part about it. So looking forward, Sterling, once you're stacking up cash, get that dry powder ready for when an opportunity comes, are there specific markets you're going to look in? Or is it more just like, if there's a deal, there's a deal?
So here in Houston, still steadily in Indianapolis, also Louisville and Lexington, Kentucky, and then Cincinnati and Columbus, Ohio, and then Kansas City, Missouri. So those are the key primarily Midwestern markets. And then out here where the toilets are a little bit smaller in Texas.
And Houston has the most multifamily units in total, I think. It's probably total and per capita because they got a crazy number of multifamily units. Why some of those other Midwest states?
Because they're very comparable to Indianapolis. Okay. And then from the economics, and then also looking at the price per unit in correlation to the rents. So just from that, from an underwriting standpoint, it's easily to translate that model to those specific other models, other markets.
Do you tend to see more cash flow in those markets?
It's about, from my experience, about the same, but I haven't found any deals. So it's been about the same, I would say.
Yeah, we briefly looked in Indianapolis. I still love Indianapolis, so I'm going to still look there. But the reason we did that was to search, one, to diversify a little bit. Love the Midwest. Saw a lot of people from Chicago are moving there. Businesses are moving there. And we thought it would be a place where we could find a little more cash flow than we had been finding and maybe a little less competitive. And boy, were we wrong. We were submitting on deals and getting outbid by, man, 15, 20%, like you were saying, which yeah. just didn't make any sense. So I think that's happening everywhere. And I think it just comes down to picking a market because the fundamentals meet your criteria and then just underwrite, because I've seen it happen before where someone underwrites one property and they find a deal, but that's very, very rare. And quite honestly, frustrating too.
When you're mentioning about the people paying 15, 20% more, the third deal, this was an 80 unit that bought it for $3.35 million in 2018. And then years later, just 2 years later, sold it for $5 million. I have no way in hell, understand, I'm not a customer, but how did that person make that work at $5 million? We're looking at it from an operation standpoint, and I just don't understand how they could make that work.
And it's to your point earlier about you just don't know how people are buying. And it's like, that could be a big mistake, or it could be someone that's just parking cash. Could be someone.
Exactly. That, yes. How do you compete with someone who just wants to park cash? You don't.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I was talking to, I'm sure the listeners have heard this story many times, but I was talking to a broker in Austin, Texas, and it was a gentleman from China who had never invested in real estate, never invested in multifamily, bought a property, I think it was $25 million cash. And broker asked him like why? Because he'd never operated multifamily before. And he said, all he said was, I just heard Austin was a good place. So you're competing with that too, just people that need to park cash, because if they keep it where they have it, it'll probably lose it due to a multitude of geopolitical factors. So yeah, you just never know who you're competing with. And that's why it's important to just really stick to those guns or your underwriting and be really diligent in that.
And another example I want to provide to people too is I was on a call with this investor who they just couldn't figure out why one of their units wouldn't rent. So they had a duplex, so a very small deal. And the feedback I provided to him was, you bought the property in the hood, and they were from California and they were investing in Indianapolis. So I know they, one, overpaid for the property. So now that's just a prime example of individuals chasing yields, not realizing what they're investing in, overpaying for it. And then that now affects everything else too.
Yeah. Another reason why there's going to be opportunities, because those mistakes that are made, someone hears, oh, Indianapolis is a hot market. All right, let's go buy something there. And then I think if you're going to do that, it's important to have boots on the ground. Like,
exactly. Yes.
And yeah, I wouldn't do it in any other way, just because even though you can go there and feel it out, it's still not the same as someone who has lived there for years.
And this is another last example on that same note, that an investor I was speaking with out of state, they were investing in Indianapolis. They could not fathom how street by street it was. I said, yeah, that's a good street. But then you go to the next street, it's, they could not fathom that. And that's just a prime example of boots on the ground, but how quickly things can really transition, and markets are different.
Yeah. And to your point, you wouldn't know that. You would not know that if you didn't live there.
Exactly.
Oh, that's great. So Sterling, if you don't mind getting into the investor side of things, I'd love to talk to people on that. How are you sourcing capital? I know we haven't really said it, but you're a syndicator, correct? How are you doing that? And have you seen anything change over the last 4 or 5 months?
So I would say is I've taken the route of content marketing, and I learned this from the book Jab, Jab, Right Hook by Gary Vaynerchuk. So value-based content. And then also I multiplied and put a lot of efforts, and I got that principle from the 10X rule. So how I originally started was just pushing out content, leveraging biggerpockets.com was one, being on others' podcasts, having my own podcast and YouTube channel. So these are all lead generators as an inbound form of marketing. So people come to the content, they get value from it. At the end, there's a call to action, hey, visit, or they get so much value from it. And then they find out, oh, okay, well, he actually operates apartments too. I'm actually looking to passively invest in deals. So you're able to build the trust, because that's first and foremost is the person trusting you, and you're able to build that credibility. So that's the strategy that I've always used as a way to get people into the funnel, for lack of better words.
Yep. Is there a platform you like better than others, or is it just about utilizing, you know, as many as you can?
Bigger Pockets really was a good lead generator, especially when starting out. they've since expanded. So contributors aren't able to contribute as much, myself in particular, as much as I can. So from that, the second one is podcasts, such as the one that we have, is just being on others' podcasts and having your other, being on others' podcasts, and then also having your own, I would say, is a second top lead generator.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Once you start making the rounds on podcasts, yeah, I've seen the most. I think it's just a medium that people like. You can listen to it when you're in the car, when you're traveling, on the way to work, whatever it happens to be, working out. And it's just a great way to get a lot of information from a lot of different types of people. So exactly. I agree. All right. Before I ask you the last two questions of the show, first, where can listeners find you if they want to reach out?
Yeah. So one is sterlingwhiteofficial.com. That is sterlingwhiteofficial.com. And then also I'm on YouTube as well. So you just type in Sterling White and just look for a bald, handsome guy, smiling, cheesing. Click on the avatar and you can find tons of content. I push anywhere between about 3 to 4 pieces of content per week.
Busy guy. I can tell you content creation is like a second job. I know you'll say the same.
And it's something I enjoy doing, the content side. And the other thing I want to mention towards the beginning is focusing on your strengths and then having people around you on weaknesses. And there's still some things, I'm not going to lie, that I do that I don't enjoy doing, but I quickly build myself up to a point to where I can quickly get that off my plate.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. The who, not how. Love it. All right.
Is that a book? I have to check that out.
Yeah. It's a great book. Okay. I just read it actually.
Who, not how. Okay. I'll check that out.
All right. Last two questions. First one has two parts and it's, why did you choose multifamily for your vehicle to reach your goals? And part B of that, what type of life has it provided you?
I'd say, why not multifamily? And that's probably a common thing people say. But so why not? But it's more scalable. I've had the 150 single families. It was a nightmare from a management standpoint. So it was self-managing and had quite a bit of employees, quite a bit of, what is it, volume in order to get to that scale. So it just made the most sense to make that transition to multifamily and then done that through syndications. And I would say it's really given me the lifestyle. And one thing also is I'm a minimalist, so it really doesn't take much for me to live on anyway, but also just being able to travel. Is I can work when I want. It just so happened to be I just work all the time, but just not even work for me. But well, sometimes it is. So is having the freedom. I just got back from Mexico 2 weeks ago. And from that is multifamily and real estate has allowed me to just go out there and live more life and not have to be stuck in a 9 to 5 and having to clock in and exchange time for money.
Hell yeah, man. It's all about working for your dream, not someone else's.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Last question. Typical, if you had a time machine, Sterling, and you could go talk to your younger self. So this show is not only about multifamily, but about personal finance. So I do Multifamily Mondays, Finance Fridays. So if you could go back to your younger self and give one piece of financial advice, what would that be?
This will be a two-parter. So, and this will get a little deep, but
let's do it.
Yeah. With the upbringing I had, it wasn't from the side. His mother did the best she could, but 1 minute, she was all upbeat. Next minute is she's a completely different person. So I was always walking on eggshells with that relationship. So first and foremost, I would go back to that kid and say, Sterling, it's going to be okay. You're going to make something out of yourself. I know that person's telling you day in and day out that you're not going to amount to anything, but just stick with it. It'll be fine. So that's the first thing. And then second is I'd say the piece of advice from a financial standpoint, invest in yourself. That'll be the best ROI that you'll get.
A lot of people try to skip that step. And it's really important to invest in yourself. And don't think of it as spending money. It's investing money. To your point, it's the best ROI. All right, man. I really appreciate you coming on here and taking time. It means a lot. I know you're a busy guy. So thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Sean. And for you, is what piece of advice would you give your younger self?
For financial advice?
In general, let's say personal. You don't have to go as in-depth or that personal of a story I did.
No, I appreciate you asking. So I was actually on a podcast recently and they asked a similar question. It would have been going back in time, telling my younger self, recently graduated from college, started a degree in finance, had some disposable income, lived in a city. The city was my playground. The city's your oyster per se.
Oh, man.
It would have been like, have fun, but like, you don't need to have all the fun. There's a lot of time for that. I'm not saying you can't go have a drink with your friend. You got to stay in on weekends and hustle. I'm not saying that. Like, you should do that sometimes for sure, but you should have a little fun, but also work. And it goes to that saying of do things that most people won't do today. So you can then do things in the future that most people can't. And I'm very proud and great for where I am today, for sure. And I will never take any of that for granted. And it goes to your point earlier about gratification. I try to do that as much as possible. But if I had told myself that when I was younger, I'd be in a completely different spot today. That's probably what I told myself.
I'm glad you had brought that up, because where I was able to get to where I am now is that those early 20s, I completely blocked off all my friends, great people, and I just put my head down. And then that now is I have the freedom due to that. And many of the people that just partied, having a good time, women, guys, all that, whichever floats your boat, is they're in a different position in life. And I know it's those are, from my opinion, it's sacrifice, but I believe those are really the prime years to have. You have the a lot of times the most energy. So from that, and by putting your head down, is that sets you up for the future. So it's just, what is it, making that sacrifice?
Yeah, it's what pain do you want, right? So
exactly, yes.
It's your choice. And yeah, I've been sacrificing for the last few years. Just wish I had sacrificed a little earlier on.
Well, most people still don't even realize that. So that's another leg up that you do have.
True. Hey, thanks for asking. I'm glad you did, because I think that's important for most people, not just because to sacrifice, but also just to have gratitude for the things that you have accomplished and the stuff that I know you and I will accomplish in the future. So,
and you got 10 fingers, you've got your eyesight, and it's so easy to get into the FOMO through the social media. And I want to go back to Beth, is you see all this, but then, and of course, I know we still want to strive to be better and be more, but then there's the, okay, even through that, all right, I know we got the podcast and there's so many rabbit holes that I can go into.
No, you're good, man. I recently talked about this on, I think it was my podcast, about the FOMO thing and how you can get tied up seeing what others are doing and think you're not doing enough and you need to do more. And then my point to it was, can't necessarily stop that from entering your mind, but the thing to do to get out of it, for me at least, that's worked really well, is gratitude. Yeah. Once you do that, you can't think that way anymore, because how could you?
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, man. Dang, I'm going to have you back on so we can have more of a mindset discussion.
Yeah, mindset, and then also the tinfoil hats and go.
We'll do that the second half. Maybe I should add a tinfoil hat question to my end questions.
The guest has to have a tinfoil hat and then make sure they're it's not bugged around to have those
conversations. All right, everybody, get your tinfoil hats on. That's amazing. Love it. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for your time. And listeners, as always, remember, easy doesn't pay well, and instant gratification is self-destructive. So always remember, it's not just working hard for your money, but having your money work hard for you, so then you can go create the life of your dreams. All right, everybody, let's get after it. Catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.